Okay. Not sure what we missed today. Gosh. To call a couple of COVID cases. Anyway. Okay. So welcome back to week 3. Welcome to all those on Zoom. Week 3. We're doing the vulnerability, the good and the bad. And we're basing some of it on Brené Brown's book, The Gift of Imperfection. So just a bit of a review from last week. Last week we talked about the concept of living wholeheartedly, to come to a relationship or to come with ourselves, everything that's a part of who we are, which includes a healthy acceptance of self, which means to understand our own self-worth, that we are always worthy of love and belonging, and the acceptance of ourselves and others, both in relationships with people, and ultimately, as we explained, the same is true with our relationship with God. And we said that connection that we have with others can only happen if we show up wholeheartedly. We brought this idea that the same is, we know in Judaism, with our relationship with God, where it's, we say in the Shema, b'chol avavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol ne'odecha, we've got to come completely, right? And therefore, we talk about connection. A real friend is, on the, you know, there's many friends, but a real friend, as it says in Berkei Avot, that sometimes a person can have only one real friend, which is okay, because a real friend is someone you can connect with completely. Where we sort of differed a bit with the writings of Renee is what self-acceptance means, that she talked about this idea of waking up and saying, I'm enough. I don't think that's true. We shouldn't say I'm enough. Enough is not a good thing to say. In Judaism, we're never enough, meaning we're never, because we're always growing. Not in a judgmental sense or a negative sense, but we're always growing. Enough is very limiting. We need growth. We need yigi'ah. As the Talmud says, we need to always work hard and always strive for something higher, always strive to improve, always strive to take responsibility for the things which we need to fix. We don't define ourselves by them, and therefore we accept our worthiness, but we certainly try and deal with them. And as I said, it's going to come up a lot. I think this is running, as I'm preparing this and as I'm reading her work, I think this is the key difference here, in that is that Jewish living is very different than just regular living, meaning, it's not unique to Jewishness, I'm just saying it certainly is in Judaism, that life is very much about a set of values. And when you live a life of values, then you always have to strive, because you're always striving to live by those values. Now, everyone might be in a different place in their journey, and that's fine, and not everyone can embrace everything at the same time, but there's certainly a set of values which we hold up as the absolute truths and the goals, and therefore we're not enough, because we're always trying to live by our values, we're always trying to strive to accomplish, and values are those values which bring meaning and purpose. So therefore it's not just about living life efficiently or in a happiness context or with inner peace, it's much more than that. It's actually living a life where we can achieve meaning and purpose. So that's why we always need to grow. And self-acceptance is important, but not that we're enough. It's rather that we're worthy. And whatever we do, we're worthy. We're never defined by our failings or weaknesses, but we certainly strive to move closer to our goals. Now, we talked about this idea. It certainly doesn't happen overnight. It's a process. It takes effort. It takes practice. When we talk about being vulnerable and sharing with others, we also talked about a story that she wrote about, which was very good, and that when she felt shame and wanted to show up wholeheartedly and share that shame or share that vulnerability with someone else, it was a careful choosing of who we share it with. It's got to be someone who's not judgmental, someone who will accept, someone who will be compassionate, empathetic, not someone who will judge or give solutions, just someone who will listen and bond, right? So that was the concept we talked about before. Now, before we go on, just that concept I said before about living with values and never accepting where it is now but always growing, I want to just interject there a little bit and just go off topic for a few moments, off topic, on topic kind of thing, and talk about, because today we know is a very special day in the Jewish calendar, it's Lag BaOmer. And of course one of the heroes of Lag BaOmer is Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva, one could say, is a symbol of someone who always strived and always grew and was not accepting of status quo at all. maybe accepting of his worthiness, but he wasn't accepting of his potential, which is why he got where he got. But he never accepted where he was as, this is who I am, kind of thing, right? And this we see in different parts of his life. First of all, the way he started off. We know Rabbi Akiva was 40 and he was illiterate, right? He only started to study when he was 40. It's hope for all of us, eh? Sure. And he became Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is probably one of the greatest sages of the Talmud, right? And the bulk of Jewish learning that we have today, known as the Oral Torah, comes from Rabbi Akiva. Was ignited by Rabbi Akiva.
How long did he live?
He lived very long. He lived over 100.
Oh.
Yeah. But he became, when he started studying, he was 40. And of course, the background to that was he was illiterate completely. He didn't even know the alphabet. I mean, there's some beautiful stories there. Part of the story, of course, is also his wife. He worked for someone called Kalba Savo, who was a very wealthy individual in Israel, and he shepherded his flock. He was a shepherd. And Kalba Savo's daughter liked him, saw potential in him, saw greatness in him. And against the wishes of her father, actually, she married him and said, I will do everything that you will be able to grow and learn. And he did. He went away to yeshiva for many, many, many years. And she didn't, she instigated all that. And came back 24 years later with 24,000 students, who then tragically all died around this time, right? But I'm getting to that. She accepted him. Exactly, you see, it comes back to this concept of acceptance. Acceptance doesn't mean that you accept a person for what they are now. You accept the whole of them because of their true worth, their true potential. Very different. It's a very different form of acceptance, right? Meaning, because in modern context, I talk about acceptance, I accept you with all your failings, which is good. I don't judge you, which is fantastic. But I accept you to stay the way you are, and that's fine. I accept you wholeheartedly. But that's not the way it works in Judaism. Not with ourselves and even not with others, really. We never judge people, but we inspire them to change. We inspire them to grow. We inspire each other to grow, right? And she accepted Rabbi Akiva, but she inspired him to grow. And he did. He did also because he had that famous story, beautiful story, where he observed a spring that was dropping, like a thing of water that was just dropping one drop at a time on a stone. And eventually, it created a hole in the stone. So you figure, well, if that can happen with the stone, it can happen to my brain too. So a little bit, step by step. He said, well, we'll start with Aleph and Beis and keep growing, right? So that was very, it's an amazing thing. Yeah, so, but then later on was the amazing story. After he had these 24,000 students, there's a whole story, they didn't respect each other properly and so on and so forth. They tragically died. Now, these 24,000 students he had, with tremendous efforts, right, amassed them and got them. And yet they all died, and the world was left with emptiness, because they were supposed to be the next generation of Jewish wisdom, of Torah study, right? And you just imagine if you put yourself in Rabbi Akiva's shoes, like he had started at 40, with great tremendous toil and effort, had grown, and became a teacher, and received 24,000 students, and they all died. So a regular person would say, okay, well that's it, we're done. Failed experiments, time to retire, right? And on the spot, Rabbi Akiva didn't do that. He said, no, I'm not accepting the way it is. I'm going to go and restart. And he went to the south of Israel, the Talmud tells us, and he ordained five students. He found five students, just five, but some of the greatest. One of them being Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, whose yahrzeit is on Lag BaOmer as well, and you know, he was the author of the Zohar and so on and so forth, right? But these were great students who became the basis of all Jewish wisdom we know today. They're both legalistic and esoteric, right? This is Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shem Bachar, Rabbi Yossi, amazing people. And Torah flourished again. And if not for that resilience of Rabbi Akiva, and if not for that determination of no, we're going to keep going, we wouldn't have Jewish wisdom the way we have it today. We wouldn't have the Talmud the way we have it today, which was incredible. Which I'll just, on the topic, just end off with a beautiful idea that I saw. I mentioned it on Tuesday, but we know that Lag BaOmer is a day of celebration, so there's two reasons that are given. One reason is that it's the Yartzeit Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who revealed the mysticism part of Torah, and he instructed on the day that he died that it should be a day of celebration. He said that day he reached a very perfect state of being in terms of his connection with God. And he said every day, every year on this Lag BaOmer, there'd be a tremendous energy, and so therefore he asked people to join in his celebration. And the other reason that's given is because the epidemic that affected the students of Rabbi Akiva, and they died, it says on Lag BaOmer, they stopped dying. Right? They stopped dying. So that's why we eat, because normally the Omer is a time of partial mourning, but on Lag BaOmer, they stopped dying, so we ease the mourning, right? So some of the commentators ask, what is that supposed to mean? That's not a cause of celebration. They stopped dying because there was no one left to die. if you say 10,000 people are destined to die and only 5,000, then it stops suddenly. Okay, so it's tragedy, but then it's cause for a little bit of celebration, the fact that the next five have survived, right? But here there's no, what's the simcha? They all died. God said he condemned them all to a very harsh punishment because they were great people and God held them to a high standard. And they all died, and there's no one left to die. So what do you mean, paskul lamut, they stopped dying? What does that mean? Why is it a celebration? So one of the great halachic commentators, the Pri Chadosh, says the following, and he says, the story's like this. The miracle or the celebration is that they all died, but Rabbi Akiva ensured that they didn't die. They stopped dying, meaning he continued the legacy. And he got up and he determined on Lag BaOmer, he went and he said, okay, we're going to start again. And we're going to take the five students and we're going to rebuild Torah all from scratch. That's what it means, they stopped dying. Otherwise, if he hadn't done that, then they would have truly died in every sense of the word, like physically and spiritually, would have been finished. The whole thing would have been done. But it means they stopped dying, that he prevented the eternal death. In other words, that they should live on in the next sort of phase of the whole journey.
Five students.
No. The five students were new. They were new students. No. There was new. It was a whole new thing, a whole new phase. Yeah. All right. So let's go back to where we are. So
basically, he said never say die.
Yeah. No. We gotta keep going. Okay. So let me go back to Brené Brown's book that we're talking about, and again how one lives like that, and how one is able to sort of show up with everything that we have, and to even be vulnerable, and so on. So in the book, she addresses a number of specific areas where this comes out and how we show this, how we manifest this in very different ways, which we'll do over the next few weeks. But the first thing she does is she discusses some general principles that makes this type of living all possible. And I started talking about it at the end of last week, but she has this chapter, a very beautiful chapter, where she talks about three things that she believes are the three core principles, which she refers to as courage, compassion, and connection. All right? Now, connection is the goal, because as I said the first time we spoke about this last 2 weeks ago, that in her research she discovered that the happiest people were those that had a connection, had relationships, which we know to be true. People are wired for connection, but she found that real connection is only possible when you have the courage to be vulnerable. Right. So therefore, she has these three things: courage, compassion, and connection. Now, it's interesting, the connection between being vulnerable and having courage. What does that mean? So she makes a very interesting point. We're going to go through all three of these things. So in terms of courage, she says the following. She says, I'm going to read to you just one or two paragraphs. After interviewing people about the truth of their lives, their strengths and their struggles, I realized that courage is one of the most important qualities that wholehearted people have in common. And not just any kind of courage. See, here she defines what courage actually means, and it's an interesting point. I found that wholeheartedness requires ordinary courage. What do I mean? So she's like this. The root of the word courage is C-O-R, the Latin word for heart. My Latin is not good, so I'm taking a word for it. Right? In one of its earliest forms, the word courage had a very different definition than it does today. Courage originally meant to speak one's mind by telling all one's heart. Over time, the definition has changed, and today courage is more synonymous with being heroic. Now, heroics is important, and we certainly need heroes, but I think we've lost touch with the idea of speaking honestly and openly about who we are, about what we're feeling, and about our experiences, good or bad, is the foundation of courage. Heroics is often about putting our life on the line. Ordinary courage is about putting our vulnerability on the line. In today's world, that's pretty extraordinary. That's a very beautiful point, and what happens is it comes out in many, many different examples, and I'm just going to sort of show you a few. Some of that she says and some just that I've thought about. You know, because sometimes the most simplest things that we think are simple need a lot of courage. Need a lot of courage either because we're insecure or we pursue perfectionism, which is a problem. We're always trying to be perfect. We're always trying to hide our insecurities or our weaknesses and so on and so forth. For example, the Talmud makes a point and says, Lamed l'shoncha lomar eini yodeh. A person should always teach their tongue to say, I don't know. Right? That sounds like it's just interesting. It's such a simple thing, right? But there are a lot of people that will never say, I don't know. Ask you a question, I don't know. Why? Because of perfectionism. People like to be perfect. People don't like to show that I'm lacking something, right? And especially when people expect you to know, right? So if you got an area of expertise, and people ask you a question in that area, right? Someone might ask me a halachic question, assuming that I know all the halachic answers, right? Which I don't, right? Saying I don't know is hard sometimes because you're letting the person down, right? That's an amazing thing. It's like a simple thing. That's part of courage. Like having the strength. It's a strength, not a weakness. The reason why people don't say I don't know is because they think I don't know is a weakness, where really I don't know is a strength. And that's how you grow. That's showing up wholeheartedly, saying, no, part of, I'm not perfect. And that's okay. I'm going to find out. Saying I don't know, I once heard from a rabbi, he was saying that when he was a boy, he walked into a store and an older guy came over to him and says, do you know where so-and-so is? Do you know where so-and-so lives? So he said, ich weiß nicht, I don't know. And the guy got angry. He said to him, Bacher, was machst du mit den Plätzen? Which means, young man, why are you making with your shoulders? Like, you know, he shrugged, I don't know. And he said, but I really don't know. So he explained, there's two kinds of I don't know. There's an I don't know, I'm sorry, I actually don't know, right? Or, I don't care, right? So when the Talmud says, you teach your tongue to say, I don't know, it's not that I don't care is not a weakness or a strength, it's just it's nothing, right? It's not a good thing. I don't know means, I genuinely don't know, but actually, I care, so either I'll find out, like if it's in that kind of case, I'm sorry, I don't know, but maybe someone else knows, I'll ask someone, or you know, I'll go out of my way to help you, or whatever. Or if it's something that person's supposed to know, like I don't know, but I'll find out, right? And this is what makes growing people, good people. You know, you see this in the medical field. I remember a little story of my daughter who's hosting me now, but when she was a little girl, it must have been, I don't know. We just arrived in Australia not long, which must have been 2 or 3. I remember one Friday afternoon, and these things always tend to happen Friday afternoon. She got a very bad cough and she couldn't breathe properly. I don't know, I was a bit scared. So we called a doctor. Some of you might remember him, Dr. Bloom. Do you remember Dr. Bloom?
Yeah.
Dr. Bloom was our doctor. He was an amazing, amazing doctor. Like, we always thought he was like so, I mean, he was brilliant. And he could die, it was unbelievable. And he came just before Shabbos and we were getting nervous, like it's almost Shabbos. He was perfectly calm, I remember. And he examined her and he says, I think I know what it is, but actually I'm not sure. And I was shocked, Dr. Bloom doesn't know. But it was amazing greatness. He said, give me 1 second, it was before cell phones and everything. Took an old telephone book, looked up the number of a pediatrician that we all knew, and he was also great. Dr. Kleiner, remember? And he called him up and he described him the symptoms, and actually it wasn't what he thought it was something else. And Dr. Kleiner explained to him why. I remember just this moment, you know, it's still sticking in your head because it's a good moment, you know. Closed the telephone book and says, I've learned something new today. And I thought, that's why he's a good doctor. It's like, that's greatness, right? But sometimes it takes courage. So that's what the Talmud says. Teach your tongue to say, I don't know. Or when you're on the receiving end, and she makes, this is Brené Brown's point, it's a good point. Like, when you teach, for example, and someone says in the class, you teach students or young students or little children, right? And someone shyly puts up there and says, I really don't understand what you just said, right? Sometimes that takes courage in a crowd. Why? Because everyone's sitting in the crowd, thinks that everyone else understands. And that must be the only dumb guy that doesn't understand what's going on, right? So she says, interesting thing, she says, I know that if one person can find the courage to say you've lost me, there are probably at least 10 more students who feel the exact same way. They may not take the risk, but they certainly benefit from that one person's courage, right? Or another example I was thinking of is something we've talked about a lot is the idea of a difficult conversation, right? It takes a lot of courage. So we know this, you know, we've talked about this before. We know that if someone does something to you, right? So we know the Torah's instruction of not to hate someone in your heart, right? Which means either make it insignificant enough so you don't worry about it, or communicate it. But we said communicating it, there's normally three responses. Some people just don't communicate it until it explodes, so they hold it within them, which isn't healthy. Others explode and get angry, which is ineffective. And the effective way of doing it is to actually sit down with a person and communicate. But it actually takes a lot of courage. And a lot of people don't do that. Sometimes in the guise of being very good, I say, I hate confrontation. Yeah. I'm a peace-loving person. So what do you do for the next 25 years? You walk around with it in your heart until you explode, right? That's not... Communication is really important. Having a difficult conversation is really important. But it's difficult. It is difficult. Because it's a risk. You don't know if it'll be received. You don't know if it'll be a failure. You don't know how the person will react and so on and so forth. So therefore, it's part of courage, right? Well, another example, just giving different examples of cases where actually the simplest things take a lot of courage. It all boils down to one thing. It's the courage to show our weakness. Which is okay. Because we need to share our weaknesses with others, as we talked about last week. And we need to accept ourselves that we have those weaknesses. She talks about the courage of her own daughter. When she says, my own daughter, Ellen, when she called me from a slumber party at 10:30 p.m. and she said, Mom, can you come get me? When I picked her up, she got in the car and she said, I'm sorry, I just wasn't brave enough. I got homesick. It was so hard. Everyone was asleep. I had to walk to Libby's mom's bedroom and wake her up. Wow. Right? So that is. I mean, she couldn't do it, but she was honest about it. And then, that's the part. So, what is this all about? It's part of what they talk about today also. It's part about being real and being authentic, right? So, being perfect means you're not authentic because you never show up completely with the whole of yourself and pretend. We pretend a lot. Being authentic means I'm able to share. I'm able to say, this is who I am at the moment. This is my weakness. This is my insecurity. This is what I don't know. This is what I do know. This is what I can do. This is what I can't do. And it's being honest. It's a real authentic thing. But again, and I'll probably keep saying this for the next 5 weeks, right? We always have to make sure that it's proper, that it's for the right reason, right? In other words, it's always good to be authentic, but never good to be a victim, right? Like, it's also good to say, you know, this thing really bothers me. Well, I'm really disappointed about this thing, or something like that, right? You know, she talks about the fear of being disappointed or having a, you know, she talked about television interviews which didn't go well or she hoped she would get them and she didn't get them. It's all good. And it's okay to be honest about them and authentic about them and say, you know, this, I really expect this to happen. I'm really disappointed it didn't happen, right? But it's always good, therefore, to be authentic, but at the same time, to manage what we're going through. In other words, comes back to the same point I mentioned a few weeks ago, that when we share authenticity, when we share vulnerability, it's about accepting that we have it now, but it's also working with it. It's not accepting it as a fait accompli, right? Because I might feel very disappointed about something, I might feel very insulted about something, I might feel very hurt, or I might feel very inadequate. But I have to own that, it's part of me, and that's why I'm okay to share it. It's okay to share it because it doesn't define me. But it's not okay to accept it completely. This will always be me. Because I have to work with it. And maybe the things that bother me shouldn't really bother me down the track. Maybe I need to get to a track where get to a point where this doesn't bother me anymore, where my needs are not so complicated, where I can not take myself so seriously, or whatever the case is. But if I didn't do that till now, that's fine. As long as I acknowledge that, as long as I'm authentic about that, and as long as I don't have, as long as these things don't define who I am. Now, in order to have courage, she makes a very interesting point. In order to develop this courage, not to be perfect and to share our weaknesses and inadequacies and so on, we have to have what she calls compassion. And compassion is a few different things. It's interesting, what would be the connection between courage and compassion, right? Compassion is compassion on ourselves, because then we're able to accept ourselves and be authentic about ourselves. And it also has to do with compassion on others, and we'll see what that means. So let me read you a paragraph where she talks about compassion. She says, looking at the word compassion, right? If we take a closer look at the origin of the word compassion, much like we did with the word courage, we see why compassion is not typically our first response to suffering. Listen to this, interesting idea. The word compassion is derived from the Latin word, I don't know how to pronounce these things, but pati and cum or something, meaning to suffer with. I don't believe that confession is compassion is our default response. I think our first response to pain, either our own pain or someone else's pain, is to self-protect. We protect ourselves by looking for someone or something to blame. Or sometimes we shield ourselves by turning to judgment or by immediately going into fix-it mode, right? That's a very interesting point. In other words, if I'm very upset about something, either a weakness of my own, something, a failing of my own, an inadequacy of my own, or something that happened to me which is painful, right? So it is interesting. We always, while it's happened, it must be this one's fault, or that thing's fault, or the weather's fault, I don't know, anything, someone's fault, right? Why? Because we don't like ourselves enough almost to live with that pain. To say, no, it just happened because it happened and it's part of me now and I've just got to live with it and accept it, right? And it's mine and I own it and ultimately I take responsibility for it if I need to. So we try to cover up for it, right? So that's this interesting, or the same thing with other people. As I said last week, very, very often when we hear about other people's pain, we lack empathy because we judge. Right? Empathy comes from compassion. So we think, oh, that person's done it again. Like, you know, if only they would, I don't know, if only they would have taken my advice 3 years ago and gone to the proper doctor or something, I don't know, whatever, right? That kind of thing. Or they keep making the same mistake again and again, so obviously they're going to do that kind of thing, right? So we don't have compassion, and therefore we don't have empathy, because we judge. Or, like she said last week, we don't connect properly to people who have pain, we don't have proper empathy or compassion. Why? Because we start to fix it. So someone comes to us with a problem, they don't ask us for advice, but, oh, that's terrible, I'll tell you how to fix it. Which is not what we're looking for. We're looking for connection, understanding, acceptance, right? So, that's the difference, but in order to accept our pain or others' pain, in all we need compassion. We need to say, no, it's okay. It doesn't define me. It's part of me. This is who I am. If I need to share it with someone else, I'll say I can't do it. I'm really sorry. And so on and so forth. But that compassion comes from the courage. The courage to not be perfect. The courage to not pretend. The courage to not show up half, but show up wholeheartedly. When we have that courage, then we're okay with it, then we can accept it, and then we can have compassion to ourselves and to others. Does that make sense? Yeah. Now, in this section of compassion, and here again, I'm going to sort of encourage people to be very careful about this. She talks about boundaries and compassion. Okay? Boundaries is a very common word nowadays. Yes. Right? We've got to create lots of boundaries. Now, do we have to create boundaries? Of course. But we also have to be very, very careful. Because like I said last week, we have to be careful not to conflate or not to confuse self-care with self-absorption. It's a very, very big difference. But let's see what the connection is. But never, having said that, boundaries is important. But let's just see how it connects to compassion. So she says, one of the greatest and least discussed barriers to compassion practice is the fear of setting boundaries and holding people accountable. I know it sounds strange, but I believe that understanding the connection between boundaries, accountability, acceptance, and compassion has made me a kinder person. Now, I remember from 2 weeks ago, her history is that when she started studying shame and all that, she actually had a breakdown for a few years, right? Brené Brown. She says like this, interesting concept. Before the breakdown, I was sweeter, judgmental, resentful. I was sweeter, judgmental, resentful, and angry on the inside, but sweeter on the outside. Okay. Today I think I'm genuinely more compassionate, less judgmental and resentful, and way more serious about boundaries. I have no idea what this combination looks like on the outside, but it feels very pretty powerful on the inside. Mm-hmm. It's a true point what you say, right? Very, very often people will always say yes. They always seem to be very kind and everything. Great, sweet people. But because they don't set any boundaries, and because they don't set any boundaries because they don't understand their own limitations, they don't have compassion on themselves, and therefore they don't have compassion on others, really. It's all about external appearances, all about perfectionism, it's all about looking good, right? Then they become resentful because they never say no. They do everything, they take on everything, and therefore they end up resenting it, they end up being inside angry and frustrated. However, sometimes when we have real compassion, A, compassion for ourselves, understanding who we are, accepting our limitations, accepting our weaknesses, accepting the fact that we're not perfect, and the truth is even compassion for others, right? Then we set boundaries. Because if for me to have compassion to you means that I don't want to resent you, I want to give to you and I want to help you wholeheartedly, completely. I want it to come from a real place, from a good place, from a wholesome place. That often means I have to be able to work with you and I have to be able to actually set boundaries and say, well, I can't do all of this, I can do half. And to say, well, no, now I'm not available because I know myself that if I overdo it, I'm going to resent it. I won't be able to help you properly tomorrow and I won't be able to have the proper empathy for you next week, right? So it's about setting those boundaries. So it's a very interesting connection between compassion and boundaries, right? And she says an interesting point. She says, during the interviews, it blew my mind when I realized that many of the truly committed compassion practitioners were also the most boundary conscious people in the study. Interesting, right? Compassionate people are boundaried people. I was stunned. Here is what I learned. The heart of compassion is really acceptance. The better we are accepting ourselves and others, the more compassionate we become. Well, it's difficult to accept people when they're hurting us or taking advantage of us or walking all over us. The research has taught me that if we really want to practice compassion, we have to start by setting boundaries and holding people accountable for their behavior, which is a very interesting connection. Right? So again, coming back to our core discussion, wholeheartedness means full acceptance of myself, full acceptance of someone else, which needs courage, comes from compassion, and it creates real connection, the ability to reconnect the whole of myself or the whole of someone else's self, right? But that compassion will require full acceptance, but also requires, therefore, real compassion, which really needs boundaries as well. Additionally, she says, if we don't follow through our appropriate consequences, people learn to dismiss our requests, even if they sound like threats or ultimatums. When we fail to set boundaries and hold people accountable, we feel used and mistreated. That's why we must sometimes attack who they are, which is far more hurtful than addressing behavior for a choice. For our own sake, we need to understand that it's dangerous to our relationships and our well-being to get mirrored in shame and blame or to be full of self-righteous anger. It is impossible to practice compassion from a place of resentment. If we're going to practice acceptance and compassion, we need boundaries and accountability. Right? Now, it's all true, but it's also dangerous. As we talk about often, right? And that's where it's also dangerous because the in Jewish living, in Jewish values, right? Obviously, self-care is really, really important. But as I've said a number of times, and I'll probably keep saying it, I think in modern society, self-care is becoming a buzzword, and it's been taken to an extreme. It's almost become like an excuse not to get your hands dirty, not to do stuff, right? And the reason for that is because while self-care is important, but a fundamental Jewish concept is humility, number one. And number two, working hard, number two. And number three, being selfless and going out of ourselves. Now, to be selfless, you also have to be there, right? It's about you being selfless. So obviously, there needs to be someone there to be selfless. So in many Jewish writings, they talk about the difference between humble and selfless and being treated like a shmata. They actually don't go together. Being selfless and being humility is not being treated like a shmata. That's all true, right? But nevertheless, the ideal is to be selfless. And the ideal is to be there for others and not be selfish and not be so absorbed in ourselves and not be so centered around ourselves, right? So again, we're going back to Lag BaOmer. You know, Rabbi Akiva was the ultimate of selflessness, right? I reckon if he was so obsessed with self-care like people are today, we wouldn't have the Talmud today, right? He would have said, you know, after he lost 24,000 students, he would have said, legitimately, so it's time for me time. It's me time now. I need to take care of myself, my own emotions. I really have to make sure I'm okay. You know, I'm going to now go to therapy for the next 25 years and then we'll see. Right? Now, I'm very, therapy is necessary. And also important to know who we are. We're not all Rabbi Akivas. But we get to tell the story, right? So this is a bit extreme what Rabbi Akiva did. That's the truth, right? In fact, I would probably counsel people that I know that if something as tragic happened to them as Rabbi Akiva, I wouldn't suggest they jump in and start ordaining 5 students because probably they do need a bit of help first, right? So we're not all Rabbi Akivas, but we need to know where we're up to. That's the truth. We also have to strive for something higher. We get to tell the stories of Rabbi Akiva because that's our model. That's our goal kind of thing. That's our aspiration. An aspiration we might never get to, but that's fine. We've talked about this often. We always use extreme examples, not because we're going to get there, but because we're going to move towards there. Very, very different, right? So you have also, like, I'll give you an example. You have the story in the Talmud about Hillel, right? Who never got angry. Hillel, it was a value by him never to get angry, right? So I can't remember the exact details of the story offhand now, but the story of Hillel is there were two people who made a bet. They said they heard that Hillel never gets angry. Why? Because Hillel excelled in this value of never getting angry. Anger is a terrible thing. Rage is a terrible thing. We've talked about this. The Talmud says that rage is as synonymous to idol worship for all the reasons we've discussed many times, and so on. It's ineffective, and so on and so forth. Right? Okay. But so two people had a discussion. They said they heard that Hillel never gets angry. So the one guy says that's rubbish. Everyone gets angry. So he says, no, it's true. I heard Hillel never gets angry. So he says, I'll take a bet with you. I'll take a bet, right? A significant amount of money. And took a bet. And the guy says, you'll see, I'll win the bet. I'll make Hillel angry. So he goes, Erev Shabbat. That's what Talmud says, right? Erev Shabbat, when it's busy. Every Jewish household, we know that the most busy time of the week is just before Shabbos, right? Doesn't matter, by the way, summer or winter. It's a very interesting historic phenomenon. That everyone knows when Shabbat is happening, and yet the last hour is always a big rush for some reason, right? Whether Shabbat comes in 8 o'clock or 5 o'clock, it doesn't make a difference. For some reason, everyone's running around, last minute things. Okay. So Hillel was in the shower or the bathtub, whatever he was doing over there, right? So this guy shows up at Hillel's house, and he says, Hillel, he doesn't even call him Rabbi Hillel. He says, Hillel, does Hillel live here? Anyway, eventually Hillel comes out very calmly. Yes, my son, what can I do for you? And he asked me some ridiculous question about why the people in Babylon have flat feet or something. I don't remember the details exactly of the question, but... And Hillel says, oh, good question. And he calmly answers him. And he goes back. And the guy shows up 5 minutes later. Those days, taking a bath was a big thing. You had to repeat up to there. It was like a big deal, right? And again, repeats the same thing. Hillel comes out, very patient. Yes, my son, what can I do for you? Asks another ridiculous question about some other nation, why their eyes are round or something, right? Anyway, it goes the third time, the same thing, Hillel comes out, good question, my son, but you know. And he says to him, and eventually after the third time, the guy says to Hillel, are you the Hillel who they call the Prince of Israel? He says, my name is Hillel. He says, well, I hope that there's never a lot of people like you. So Hillel says, why? Why, my son? What's wrong? He says, because of you, I lost 200 zuz or something. I think that was the amount, 200 zuz. To which Hillel replied, my son, it's better to learn to lose 400 zuz, but never to become angry. Okay. Now, In today's context, it was said, you know, Hillel wasn't into self-care, you got to accept boundaries, self-preservation, why was he being taken advantage of, you know, etc., etc., right? But Hillel, no, for him, the value is never to become angry. So he didn't, okay, I mean, not every day people knocked on his door, right? Today, they would have said right away, he should have blocked him on the cell phone, they should have, you know, all these things, right? Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that sometimes. Sometimes we should. We do need to create boundaries. We're not Hillel. We're not Hillel, we're not Rabbi Akiva. But we have to always know that that's not the goal. In other words, yeah, is the goal, because we should never bring ourselves to a point of resentment, and therefore we should always be honest with ourselves of where we are. But we should also try and minimize it as much as we can, right? Because ultimately we have values, and our values is we try to strive with them, and our values is to be selfless, and to help other people, and to have good relations with other people. Now, obviously sometimes it's we have to create boundaries, and even those boundaries need to be created, obviously, in a very humble way, in a very kind way, which is fine, right? And that's, I mean, that's a practical thing also. But boundaries should never become a value. It should never become like the goal, right? In other words, yes, compassion is a goal, courage is a goal, but boundaries are a necessary part of the process. But we have to always be conscious, is it a necessary boundary? And if it is, go ahead, but and do it properly and nicely. But we always have to know. And I think, again, it goes back to this concept about values. Because our starting point is not self-preservation. Our starting point is not happiness, even. Our starting point is not calm living. That's not our starting point. Our starting point are our values. Our starting point is meaning and purpose, which make happiness, absolutely, which bring happiness. If a person lives from the inside out, the inner fulfillment and the contentment is amazing, but that's not where the starting point is, actually. It's not about me. It's about being good, being godly, right? In a Jewish sense. And therefore, part of that is being humble and being selfless. Part of being selfless means create boundaries sometimes. Part of being selfless means being honest. All the things you're talking about, compassion to oneself, compassion to the others. I mean, I have people that know, I mean, everyone sets boundaries with people, doing it hopefully respectfully. Because there are people that I know if I don't set boundaries, I actually won't end up being able to help them. Because they'll drive me so crazy that I will end up blocking them and I'll never talk to them, right? But so, of course you have to have boundaries. But I'm saying that's not the ultimate goal. So I think that's something we just need to, you know, we just need to be very careful, right? And also, it's part of acknowledging who we are and accepting it, right? But also, sometimes we have to say, well, that's not my ideal, right? I'll give you an example. Let's say someone says, you know, I just can't have guests. You know, I just know myself. It irritates me. It's been nervous. I need my space. I can't have guests, right? Now, that's an honest way of talking. That's fine. And in fact, maybe if that person, they need to cool it to having guests, right? Maybe they have to say no sometimes. Someone says, you know, I need a place to stay for an hour. But at the end of the day, we know that in Jewish values, hachnasat orchim, hospitality is a value. So the Jewish approach to it is, I know where I am now, and I'm not gonna kid myself. So I'm not gonna do it. But actually, I'm gonna try and work on myself. Maybe in a year from now, I will have a bit more than I do now because it is a value, right? All that kind of stuff. So I'm saying those. We always have to know what are the Jewish values, and I might not be there now, and I have to be honest about that. And I do have to have acceptance for myself and others, and to not resent what I'm doing, and therefore to put certain limitations, but it's always about, but maybe next year I'll do a bit more because I'll be closer to my values next year. So I think that's the difference about how self-acceptance and boundaries are talked about in the modern context as apart from a Jewish context. All of this, of course, as she explains herself, leads to the ultimate thing, which is connection. And I'll just read you the paragraph, a nice paragraph, which says, I define connection as the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued. Right? That's a need of every single person, really, to feel seen, heard, and valued. When they can give and receive without judgment. When they can derive sustenance and strength from that relationship, right? So it goes back to something that we've talked about in the past, that the Gemara, the Talmud tells us, the famous thing about the Talmud saying that, why did God create the world where some people have and some people don't have, right? It was a question posed to one of the great Talmudic sages by a heretic, and said, if your God is so infinite, and he has all the resources of the world, and he is, like we say in our prayers, Poseach et Yadecha, he's someone that opens up his hand and can sustain the entire world, surely his bank account is big enough. He didn't have to only give some people and other people not, right? So the answer that was given is very simple because God wanted a world of chesed. He wanted a world of connection. He wanted a world of people to give and receive. Otherwise, the world would be a very selfish place. Right? Now, by the way, as I've said many times, this is not only to do with money. It's got to do with resources. Everyone has, and this is the point here. Everyone has something that someone else doesn't have. It might be a skill, it might be advice, it might be emotional intelligence, it might be insight, it might be resources, it might be whatever it might be, right? And therefore, the truth is that in life, we all have to give and we all have to receive. And that's what creates real connection. When we are deeply connected to each other to the point that we can support and give and take from each other and to each other, right? But to do that, this is where it comes back to this whole concept of being vulnerable. To do that, we have to be able to come to the person wholeheartedly, because we have to be ready to take and we have to be ready to give. To give compassionately, to give by accepting the whole of the person, to be accepted by the other person, and to show the parts of you that need. So yes, we don't. It's a value not to be a needy person, but it's not a value to never be a person that takes. It's very different. Because being a person that never takes means you're never vulnerable, you never show your weaknesses, you never show your deficiencies, you just be a martyr, and you strive to be perfect, and you're playing a game, and it's false, right? So therefore, connection is really important. Connection comes by a real relationship. Connection comes by giving and receiving to each other, and that can only happen when there's real relationships and acceptance. Because when we talk about giving, it means giving without resentment. It means receiving. It means receiving without being resented, which goes back to the courage and the compassion that we talked about before, right? And she says, I also love knowing that I can help you and that you trust me. Connection begets connection. And that's a really, 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 really fundamental. She says, our innate need for connection makes the consequences of disconnection that much more real and dangerous. Sometimes we only think we connected. For example, technology, for instance, has become a kind of imposter for connection, making us believe that we connected when we're really not. At least not in the ways we need to be, right? And she says, interestingly, she says, for years I placed value on being the helper in my family. I could help with a crisis or lend money or dispense advice. I'm always happy to help others, but I would never call my siblings to help ask them for help, especially for support during a shame storm. All the time I would vehemently deny attachment, attaching judgment to my generous giving, but now I understand how I derived self-worth from never needing help and always offering it. That's such a fundamental thing. See, because that's why some people really are really, really kind people, but will never take. They're always the big helper, right? And that's undermining the whole plan of God to give. Because the whole godly plan of giving was to, where God didn't need us to give really. He could have just given everyone what they need. But the whole plan of us to give was that it should be connection, there should be relationships, there should be chesed in the world. But chesed means it's got to be a two-way street. It's got to be mashpia and makabel, giving and receiving. Which means I give you wholeheartedly, compassionately, empathetically. I give you things you need because I build that connection, but the connection is incomplete if I can't come to tell you, you know, I need something too. Because I have a weakness. And it's not the same area that I gave you, but you can give me with something. Because I can take when I need. It's knowing what we need, it's having the courage to show that weakness and to show that vulnerability and to show that insecurity and to ask someone to help you. Help you doesn't mean necessarily giving something. It might just mean listening. It might just mean empathy or compassion. It might just be the strength of support. But you really need to feel that you can really trust that person to give it to you. Right? And that's why the courage and the compassion leads to connection. The wholehearted journey, she says, is not the path of least resistance. It's not the path of least resistance. It's a path of consciousness and choice. And to be honest, it's a little counterculture. The willingness to tell our stories, feel the pain of others, and to stay genuinely connected in this disconnected world is not something we can do half-heartedly. To practice courage, compassion, and connection is to look at life and the people around us and say, I'm all in. It's a very nice way to end that chapter. So that's the basis of this whole concept. And what we're going to do following this is in all the other chapters of the book is showing how this plays up in different areas of life experiences, which we'll do please God, in the following weeks. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to talk more about it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi. You're welcome. All the best.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All the best.